From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to this additional episode of the Bletchley Park podcast, Collegiate Connections. During World War II, 34 alumni of St Hugh's College, Oxford, ended up working at Bletchley Park and its outstations, and in March 2020, the college will be holding a symposium to celebrate them. In this, the last of three episodes this month, our oral history officer, Jonathan Byrne, tells us how this has opened up a potential new source for us to discover more of our veterans and to hopefully capture more stories before it's too late. The rest of this episode is given over to the fascinating stories of Nancy Sanders and Wenda Reynolds, two of those St Hugh's College ladies.
All of the information we gather from our veterans alongside their recollections allows us to look at their experiences from many different perspectives. One theme we've been investigating recently is veterans who joined us as alumni from universities or colleges. Jonathan, do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. The Roll of Honour shows us that 540 people who worked for Bletchley Park were university graduates. And I should stress, those are the ones we know about. It could well be that many more went to university. These graduates came from a wide spread of institutions across the UK and beyond.
We've been particularly looking into one college, is that right?
Yes, we were contacted by St Hugh's College, Oxford, which during the war was an all-women college. And between myself and the college, we established that 34 of their alumni worked for Bletchley Park, mostly at Bletchley Park, but a few at the Y stations as well.
And why do we think so many just from that one college would have ended up here?
I'm not entirely sure. It may well be there were personal contacts between somebody here and back at the college, and certainly with other universities and colleges, we do know that there were links between, for example, Gordon Welchman and some of the Cambridge colleges. So it may well be there were similar links from here back to St Hugh's.
And what sparked the interest in St Hugh's?
Well, it was a few years ago where they contacted me and were just comparing notes with me about which of their alumni were on our Roll of Honour. And there were some that we knew about them, but not the fact they'd been to St Hugh's College. So it was quite a good exercise between us to sort of, from their point of view, to get their alumni recognised, but also to sort of make our Roll of Honour as rich as possible.
So a bit of a joint research project, really, between us and them.
Yes, indeed. And the college is having a symposium next year to commemorate the contribution of their alumni to Bletchley Park. This, in fact, is open to the public. It's on the 7th of March 2020, which is a Saturday, and further details can be found on the St Hugh's College website.
Is this the first time we've been working with a college in this way?
No, we've had a few contacts, particularly with Oxford and Cambridge colleges, where they've run names past us and vice versa, comparing notes and making sure the Roll of Honour is as up to date as possible. And it's been very useful, very interesting. We would love to hear from other universities, other colleges, what they understand about what their alumni did at Bletchley Park. So do contact us and we'll we're very happy to compare notes. First of all, Wenda Reynolds had in fact lived in Bletchley before the war, where her father was a general practitioner, including to the Leon family. After Oxford, she was recruited by Government Code and Cipher School and worked in the administration section, dealing with recruitment of civilian staff. This is a side of the Bletchley story we don't hear a great deal about.
Is it Wenda?
Wenda. I can't stand being called Wendy.
I've never heard it before. I've heard Wanda.
My mother invented it because I know she took so long to make up her mind that father threatened to call me Astrakhan. So.
Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born in Cardiff, and when I was age six, I moved to Pembrokeshire. My father was a GP. Pembroke, yes, it was a very carefree childhood because we were running on the sands and swimming in the sea. And then when I was about 12, we moved to Bletchley.
That's a bit of a move, Pembroke to Bletchley.
Yes, I don't know why we landed there. I think my mother would have preferred to be by the sea, but there we are. Factors turned up that suited my father.
Yes. Did you ever go into the park before the war?
Yes, funnily enough. Old Lady Leon was a patient of my father's.
Oh, right.
So I used to sit outside in the car So I knew it before anyone, really.
It, by all accounts, it was a splendid sort of park.
Oh, yes, and a rose garden and all kinds of things that unfortunately were messed up. I still got somewhere a black leather wallet that she gave my father at Christmas, old Lady Lynn. When I was aged 12, I went to boarding school at Bedford, and then I went to Oxford, did my BA in Honours in English Language and Literature, and found myself a job as a kind of secretary librarian at the Royal College of Surgeons in London.
You commuted from Bletchley, did you?
Yes, yes. That was quite difficult because the trains were diverted and cancelled and very late and everything. I always remember at Euston Station, there was an area by the entrance roped off. There was supposed to be an unexploded bomb there. And everybody ducked under the rope and went straight to the entrance. So I don't think there could have been anything very lethal there. But I remember going on the roof at the Royal College of Surgeons, seeing the docks burning. They burned for days. Then I came in one morning and found that the college had been bombed. And they were going to evacuate to Ludlow. I didn't want to do that. So I went to Bletchley. Actually, I applied to Commander Denniston.
How did you know about it?
I don't know. I think perhaps one of my father's patients. He just died just before the beginning of the war. His assistant took the practice over. My mother ran the house. But so I suppose, well, people knew. Everybody knew that it was there. I wasn't very clear what it did.
No.
I remember one time they put round the walls of the main room in the mansion letters or scribbles that local people thought we were doing there. And they had the weirdest ideas. Nobody guessed what we were doing.
No, no. There must be a lot of rumours going around.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. But I applied to Commander Denniston. Evidently my papers went to him. So I got a job with the a very rough, tough, bluff Commander Bradshaw. And I remember him saying to me, oh, well, Denniston seems to like your writing, so you better come. So I don't know what it was about my application form that Denniston approved. I tell people that because he was a code breaker, you see, he could read my character from my writing.
Absolutely, yes. So you arrived there in, what, 19...?
I think it was the end of 1940, and then I left early in 45, because things dried up. Now, I was a civilian, employed by the Foreign Office, and my rank was a temporary civil servant. I've no idea what I was paid, but it was less than I was getting before.
Was it?
They were very stingy.
Yes.
I was in administration. I interviewed one or two junior people. And then I used to go and see the heads of sections because they were only allowed so many staff and keep a list of what they got and try and get the kind of staff they were looking for.
Yes.
And it was interesting to see people's MI5 forms and so.
You had all the personnel records in front of you in this
place?
Yes,
yes.
Good Lord, there must have been some secrets there or stories there.
I always remember the briefest application I'd ever seen was John de Grey. It was Nigel de Grey's son, and I think he eventually became an artist. He just put HMV BBC, summed up his covering about 12 years. Yes, so it was quite interesting because I could get into huts. People couldn't get into each other's huts, but I could get in. I can't remember which was which, but I still used to go and see Welshman, and I used to go and see Frankie Birch, who was great fun. He was the one who'd been a Cambridge professor and also went to Twankey. He was a bit of a gossip. I also remember his wife used to walk about carrying a green thermos flask because she didn't trust the water. I used to look out onto the tennis court there. My window looked out.
You were in Hut 9?
Yes.
They just exposed the foundations of Hut 9. Where Hut 9 was, after the war, was tarmacked into a car park. And they've just dug all that up and grassed it over. And when they dug it up, they found the foundations of Hut 9.
Really?
There was also the foundations of Hut 2.
Oh, the beer hut.
The beer hut.
Yes,
oh, yeah.
So that was where you met everybody. Yes.
I've heard that story about bottles of beer. Is it true?
Oh, there was the beer hut. You used to go and have your glass of beer. Oh, you could have coffee too, I think.
Yeah.
And you just sit and chat to anybody. You didn't know who they were or what they did. You see, they had musicians and poets and all kinds, and not just linguists and mathematicians. Yes.
But you stayed in Hut 9 all the time?
Yes. Well, I started off in the greenhouse, and then I remember Commander Dennison used to open the window between his room on the right-hand side, so you face it, and talk to us through the window in the greenhouse. Yeah, he's a nice little man. Always wore a monocle. And then we went into the big room, the one that they've got all their portraits in now.
Yes.
And then we went to Hut 9. But I remember when I was in the greenhouse, going to a little room on the left down there, and one of the, I think he was a messenger come porter or something, quite an old man. And there was no window in there, no air, and he was sitting there panting like a dog, poor man. And so I came back and told Bradshaw this, and he said, oh, he's all right, you know. But he did alter it.
The huts were pretty cold, were they, and dull?
Well, yes, we had radiators at the side, but no. And I remember there was some very powerful woman in the Foreign Office that people had to refer to. She wrote down about what were the conditions like, and I remember Captain Bradshaw saying, mud, 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 because there's terrible sloshy mud all around the huts, you know, and pretty cold there. And I think it cropped up something or other. And he said, well, let us know, Miss Reynolds, when you're going to start wearing trousers. Because I think somebody had said, you know, is it all right? They said, oh, just let it happen, which it did, of course.
So you were able to go into quite a few of the huts?
Yes, yes.
When you were there, you must have had a fair idea what was going on. I mean,
oh, yes.
Because some of the people I talked to knew very little. You know, they just still saw a little bit of it.
I had an overall view, I think.
Yes. So that's rare. Did the word at that time, did the word enigma mean anything to you? Did you know about it?
Yes, I knew that it was code breaking. Yes. I don't quite know. You kind of absorbed it, really.
Yes.
But I wasn't hands on. Actually, a lot of it was terribly tedious and wearing work. I was glad to be doing what I did do. It's more interesting.
Did you ever see any of the machinery or anything like that?
No.
You didn't?
No.
We hear stories of people playing rounders on the lawn. That's
well, that's right, yes.
Did you get involved in that?
I was invited to do that. Quite a select group. Captain Bradshaw was behind that. I was invited via Barbara. But I wouldn't do it because there was some woman in the team who I couldn't do with. It was a very malicious gossip.
And I
just wasn't going to get involved with that. So I had the honour of turning it down.
There's a picture of somebody skating on the lake.
Oh, yes. And then playing the squeeze box.
Yes,
that could only happen at Bletchley. Yes, that was lovely.
Yeah.
Yes, the lake was a bit of a godsend, really. Didn't often freeze over, but the tennis courts were good too. But there was a drama group, of course. I just became treasurer of that because I loved drama, but I used to get terrible stage fright, so I didn't try to act. No,
didn't take part.
But I had friends who did.
Where did they do that?
They built this hall.
Oh, down the street,
where we had breakfast. Because I remember going out to breakfast. Occasionally, you spent the night, if you were doing first aid duty, you had to spend the night in a hut and then you had breakfast. And I remember Douglas Jones, found myself having breakfast with him. And I said, I keep feeling I'm on board. And he said, it's because you've gone out to breakfast. And when I was working at the Arts Council, I was walking down the corridor and I suddenly saw Douglas Jones. I said, Douglas Jones. And he said, shush, shush. I've changed my name. Now I'm Craig, Douglas Craig. Oh, it's play reading. There's a good play reading group. I used to enjoy that. Now, sadly, there were two civilian men in the playwriting group. I used to meet them occasionally in the Bear Hut. And then they were sent to the Middle East. People used to get sent to the Middle East every now and again. And they both drowned.
Oh, dear.
Just like that, yeah. But it was kind of easy come, easy go. You know, you never knew what was going to happen to people. And then my closest friend, really, sat opposite me throughout the war, Barbara Abernethy, who married an American, Barbara Eakus, she became, Joe Eakus. So I went to stay with her in Boston a few times. She was recruited about 17, and I think she was in the Foreign Office. She was a good Italian linguist.
Yeah.
And she was billeted in Great Brickhill with several other people, including a woman, I can't remember her name, who ran the Italian section more or less, or was fairly high up in it. And Barbara worked for her. And apparently she's very foolishly sent a postcard to somebody at the same house saying something rather rude about this woman. And so she had a terrible time she got back. But I remember there was a nice, very nice man called Professor Vincent. He was an Italian section. And he said to me, she's making the girl's life a misery. And he was instrumental in getting Barbara transferred to personnel. He was a nice man. But yes, that was very unwise of Barbara.
You obviously didn't do shift work.
No, fortunately. Work. Except when we did the night duty, if you're on your first aid.
Yes.
Every now and again you had to stay there.
So you could just walk home every day.
Yes, or biked. Yes, I used to bike around, and occasionally I went to London, occasionally spent the night because I'd still got friends up there and I loved the theatre. So I used to go. But funnily enough, when I was commuting beforehand, I met some people who turned up at Bletchley later. Oh, and you put how much leave and how did I spend it? Well, it was pretty spasmodic, and Peggy Appleton, she was a little friend of mine. I think we went to Brighton, and I remember it was the beach was wired off.
Yes.
And we crawled under the wire, and onto the beach. We might have been crawling onto bombs, I don't know. Yes. It just kind of, it was so casual, really, about things.
Were you there when the place was bombed?
Yes, I was, but I was at home.
Yeah.
And we heard a bomb. It was at night, I think, but nobody was there or injured.
Yeah.
But I suppose they destroyed material there. Mm. I think it was a mistake. I think they were dropping off a bomb on the way home.
Yes.
They weren't aiming for us at all.
No. You were there right through the war. You must have met some famous people there.
Well, they weren't famous at the time.
But they've since become.
Well, we had this great sweep when so many people died. It was very, very sad. Calvo Caressi, and what I call the baby mathematicians. There was a group of young, I can't remember, there was another squat, dark man who went to America, and another one who went to Edinburgh and became very interested in birds. I can't remember their names now. Oh, and you put a few names down. I didn't know most of them. Oh, yes, Alan Turing. Now, he was in the little kind of hut behind Hut 9. And he always used to come round below my window, very shy, looking at the ground all the time, on his way to lunch. And he did have a girlfriend for a while, but that didn't work out. Very sad.
Do you ever talk to him?
Don't remember talking to him, no. Just seeing this figure going down, looking at the ground. The one who did talk to was Hugh Alexander, who never stopped talking. He was a great chatterer. He'd come in and you couldn't get rid of him. And Harry Hinsley, of course.
Yeah.
That was rather funny because that was full circle because he married Hilary Brett Smith and her father was my tutor at Oxford.
Oh, right, yes.
And so, of course, Harry came from pretty lowly beginnings, but he did well. He was brilliant. Codebreaker and so on. But I remember in Hut 9, on the other side of our room, as Barbara and me and two others, and then near a hatch on the other side of the room was a little local girl, Annie Crisps, who did the lunch vouchers or something. I can't remember the mechanics of it. Harry had broken the rules or hadn't got the right documentation to get his lunch or something like that, and he came and demanded. And she said, oh, no, you can't do it. You haven't got the right. He was furious, but she held her ground. He stomped away, having to be defeated by Annie. I always remember that. Good for her. Old Colonel Tiltwood.
You met him?
He had his tartan trews all with.
Yes.
A very nice man. Very easygoing, but brilliant, I gather.
Oh, yes.
Yes. And Barbara had a schoolgirl crush on him. Oh, look at him picking up his feet shoes. I remember Sean Wiley. I used to play tennis with him.
Yes.
He was very quick about the court, I remember. Edward Travis. Now, he took over. I didn't like him. I thought he was a bit of a bully. And I think he pushed out Denison. And his daughter, Valerie, was there. And we gave her a terrible time because determined that the boss's daughter should. She was a little thing, you know.
Yeah.
But and kept quiet. I didn't care for him. And who else was there? Oh, Bryn Newton-John, the father of Olivia Newton-John. Now, I remember he'd got a lovely voice. And funnily enough, I remember saying that to somebody. I remember thinking, I was saying, oh, he's a lovely voice. I could listen to it all day. And this got back to him in the wrong way, I think, because he thought I fancied him, which I didn't. And he asked me to play tennis. And he was a terrible tennis player. It was all on the disaster. Who else? And Joe Eakers, of course. Barbara married Joe Eakers. He's one of the few Americans. I think there was another very tall American I went to a dance with once. And I think he must have been called Kellogg. I'm sure it was something to do with cornflakes.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, there was also one, I think it was a naval intelligence. And I thought that he was quite an important chap, but nobody's ever mentioned him afterwards. They used to call him Starkey Saunders because he was so miserable. Oh, miserable Starkey. I never saw him smile. I remember I used to creep up on him because I had these special rubber soles on my shoes. And I used to make him jump, and I used to delight in doing it. But funnily enough, I saw him on a bus in London. I was always bumping into people afterwards, you know. Stuart Milner Berry, he was head of one of the sections. I was always bumping into him in the opening of art exhibitions, because I was involved with the Arts Council Club. And the latest one, I went to a play in the West End, and in the interval I went to get myself an ice cream. When I got back, there was a man standing by my seat, and he said, BP, it's a small world. And I said, which hut for you, which you always say? And he said, oh, it's not me, it's my wife. She's back in the audience. She recognised you.
All right.
And so I thought, well, and then the curtain began to go up, so he rushed back to our seats. I hoped to see them afterwards, but I was rather slow getting out. And so it was a shame. I don't know who they were. I missed them. And there was one other occasion when I went to some kind of reception at the Bishop of London. I saw the bishop's wife looking very bored and depressed, you know, beside him, facing him. And then I came along and she remembered me. And so she sprung to life and we had a great chat. I think I made her day. But so that was strange. You bump into, and then there was another man. I used to go to the little arts theatre quite a bit. And some man turned up there. And he'd been one of the huts. I knew him slightly. Turned out he's very interested in puppets. All kinds of weird things people did.
Right. Lots of eccentric people there.
Yes.
Do you remember any of the strange habits?
Well, there was a rumour that, who was the prime one? Dilly Knox. I remember he used to see him walking by in a kind of tweedy suit, but I think it was Dilly, or was it Turing? One of them used to tie their mug to a radiator.
We hear stories of famous people turning up, but I don't know whether they're true or not.
I only knew Churchill coming, but I didn't see him. And it was kept very quiet, and he was kind of whistled in and out again.
But so where were you when he turned
up? I don't know. I mean, we did. It was so quiet. It was just within the week he was coming, but we didn't know which day, and they kept it very, very quiet.
At the end of the war, I mean, the park was wound up. Were you involved in that process too?
No, I'd left before. Barbara always said that she opened it and shut it.
Right.
And of course, Churchill insisted on all the paperwork being destroyed, which was a tragedy.
So you left just before the war ended, did you?
Yes. Because they weren't recruiting anymore, you see.
Yes. Everybody was told to keep their mouth shut after the war.
Yes.
When did
30 years. I remember when I was working for the principal of Bedford College, she said to me, "What did you do in the war, Miss Reynolds, at Bletchley Park?" And I said, "I'm sorry, that's exactly what I cannot tell you." Gave me some satisfaction to say that. People got odd ideas or the tail end of things, but on the whole, people just didn't say anything. I just kind of took it for granted that it was 30 years and that was it.
So your mother never knew, presumably?
Well, not until I'd...
She was still alive, you told her.
Yeah. And very strange that she didn't really ask, you know. I don't know. People just seemed to realise that it was a secret and that was that.
Yeah. Extraordinary times, aren't they?
It was very extraordinary.
You said you'd looked at some photographs.
I've got quite a lot here and there. See, you see, I haven't got any of me when I was at Bletchley Park. We didn't seem to take photos much then. The thing is that everybody wants photographs now. And my college wants me at all ages, I think. Now the village shop wants to put a photo.
Well, I should think so too.
Oh dear, it's getting too much. But the thing is, I feel I can't let people down now.
No. Well, I think it's been fascinating stuff. Thank you very much.
Enjoy talking to you.
Thank you.
Nancy Saunders. She became an eminent archaeologist after the war. She'd spent time in Germany before the war to learn the language. And after spending some time in the Mechanized Transport Corps, she became a Wren. She worked at coastal Y stations, intercepting the voice communications of German naval vessels and aircraft, and also working on direction finding.
You could already speak German.
Yes, in German, because I'd spent quite a long time in Germany with a family, with people who taught German to English students who were reading in history. Because if you'd read history at Oxford, you had to have German. The last time I went to Germany was just before Christmas, and everything was decorated with the most lovely Christmas decorations. But it was very difficult. It was very different because you couldn't make any greeting without saying Heil Hitler. Couldn't say hello to the postman or anything. You had to say Heil Hitler first. And we knew a bit about what was happening. There were two sisters, and I accompanied one of them back. One was a teacher, and the other looked after physical comforts. And she was Jewish and had to leave. And then the other one had the difficult decision to make whether to stay in Germany or to go to England, because they had a lot of friends, particularly at Oxford. She decided she would come to Oxford, and so I went to accompany her. That was an interesting experience, because before, when I had been staying with them, it was all a rather friendly atmosphere. But this time, there was a great notice up saying Unser Gruß ist Heil Hitler. That meant you couldn't say anything to anybody unless you said Heil Hitler. To begin with, I was staying with her in the old home at Die Klauser in Jugendheim, and they'd got all their things packed up. We had to get a transit visa to go through Belgium, and there were crowds there queuing up to get their visas, and they were all Jews being refused, and they never said a word. They just turned round and walked away, and you knew that was a death sentence, and they knew too, and most of them have disappeared.
Did you come back to England just before the war or a few months?
Just before the war. Yeah. Before joining the Reds, I was in a thing called MTC, Motorized Transport Corps. And because I wasn't very good driving a car, I said I would ride a motorcycle. We were taught by ex-motorcycle people who'd been riding motorcycles in America during Prohibition. They were very good to us, very helpful indeed. And we learned all their slang. And we were taught how to ride motorcycles in rather difficult conditions, because they were very difficult sometimes. So I did take dispatches for my motorcycle, which was over the most of southern England. And that was very interesting work. We didn't know, of course, what we were doing. And I kept a record of some of those journeys. The southern area was ready, but we went down to Portsmouth and Southampton. But that was interesting as long as there was a danger of an invasion. But as soon as the danger went, I lost interest, and everybody who was interesting, who was at Reading, also left. One of the people who was there was Jack Dryburgh. The brother is Tom Dryburgh. And he was very interesting, his life. He'd walked from Turkey and, of course, could speak all the Turkish languages. And so I got some books about the language from him. But then handed back my book of Turkish, and he said, "You won't be hearing from me again for some time." And I knew that meant he had gone to North Africa, and I never did hear again from him.
Did you ever ride a motorcycle afterwards again?
I would be frightened now.
Not now, but, after the war.
No.
Why did you choose the Wrens in the first place?
Well, we only had the choice of being armed services or doing things like munitions. I wouldn't do munitions because I had rather anti-war feelings at the beginning of the war. So the last thing I wanted to do was munitions. And I heard that in the Reds, if you chose to debunk, they couldn't bring you back with a policeman. And so I thought that would be better.
Did the Navy ask you about your language skills?
No, they didn't know until I had my first interview. And I had the first interview was in London.
Where did you train, first of all, in the Wrens?
We did a short training for the Wrens just learning Lenin's language, the extraordinary language they use.
Navy language.
For instance, one notice came up saying, negative jackets will be worn. That meant you needn't wear a jacket. So you had to learn all that. That was Mill Hill.
And where did you go after Mill Hill?
To Wimbledon. There was a nice house there. And there we were quite well looked after. And there we learned our real job. We learned a certain amount about things like the ionosphere and technical things. And then we're given things to take down. And that meant writing very fast, because they did very fast speech.
Your first posting was in Loo.
Well, yes, but I was rather disappointed when I heard I was going to Loo, because I knew there'd be very little traffic down there, so it wouldn't be so interesting.
Your next posting was Lyme Regis?
I was sent to Everslip as a substitute for someone, and I opened the door of this house and heard the most lovely singing voice, because one of our wrens was a professional singer. That was lovely. But we had to be very careful that nobody knew what we were doing, of course. I remember something came through when I was first time I was on, said, shedding warning. And I thought it was a shedding warning. I was so used to extraordinary language,
yes.
I thought, oh, well, they've got something they call a shedding warning. So I said, shedding warning, of course, they all there knew it was a shedding. We were, in fact, within range of their guns, and we used to have shells over. There was something called the Battery Linderman, and that meant that we couldn't leave the building. So if we'd got a 48 hours off, we couldn't take it if there was a shedding warning on, because we were within range of this Battery Linderman. And when we were in the town, there were loudspeakers said, all army personnel must take official shelter, which was very tiresome. But nevertheless, one had to do what one was told, so that you had to go straight to the base. Aberystwyth was a very odd place. It was perched on the very edge of the cliff. Below us ran a railway from Folkestone, and we could go down under the railway and reach the sea that way. We worked with the Air Force, and the Air Force in that area were operational. There were the big aerodromes, and we were asked to provide partners for them, teach them to dance. And that didn't do when they were just back from a sortie in France. Sometimes they were so tired, you had to almost hold them up when they were dancing. Perhaps I should tell you about another complication. You see, special duties Reds had special advantages. They didn't have to wear uniform and all sorts of things like that. And the other Wrens didn't like this, and they complained. And special duties, you joined straight away as a PO or GPO. So they changed it. By the time I had joined, we had to behave exactly like the ordinary stewards and cooks. And when news of this came to Aberystwyth, they said, that's impossible, because she's on watch at night and she can't possibly sleep in the daytime in the kitchen, that sort of thing. So they fought around and they gave me an old washroom, which was at the very top of the house. And that was wonderful because the old instruments had been left in it. So as I took them on with my bunk, and I had access to wonderful music on this very high-powered instruments. The only snag was I had to have an aerial. You see, I could have sent as well as receiving. And they had an aerial, and when it rained, the water came down the aerial, and I put a bucket underneath. But when I was away on a 48, where we were allowed 48 hours off, you could go off for the night, other people took advantage of it. I let them have it, and that was all right, except that they always moved the bucket, and I couldn't get them up to. I said, it's necessary, and so on and so on, and no good. So at last I said, don't move the bucket, it's magic, and nobody moved it again. From my bunk I could see the clock tower in Calais.
Can you tell me a bit about when you were on duty, the work?
The work was twofold. There was the tower, which was perhaps the most important, which had all the DFing big material, and that so that you were listening to something, you had to get on that and give the reading of what you were listening to, put that through to control. And then you had to write that down, and also the other ear was your own headquarters and you were talking to them. So one ear was doing one thing and the other ear was doing something quite different. And you wrote it down and you had to give what you had heard.
I'm just going to show Nancy a photograph of a direction-finding tower. Does this look like the setup?
Oh, yes. And when you went to the tower, you were there cut off from local people. And so you took your food for the night and you carried a tray with coffee and egg and milk and things. And we got terrific winds. And I saw the wind was so strong, it took the milk out of a milk jug and carried it away. And in the tower, as well as the thing you were working to get on the right bearing and give the right bearing to control centre.
Did you go to Dover Castle at all?
I don't think so.
Because the messages from you went to Dover.
Yes, we didn't know where they went. We just knew they went to control. We didn't know control was in Dover Castle. The job I was doing in the Wrens, we could only work on if we were 30 miles from the people who were speaking. In this case, it was E-boats in the channel. And we knew that. We knew we were monitoring E-boats, and we knew them even by name. The captain of one flotilla was Billy Friend, I think, Billy Friend. And we heard, for instance, he would say, I've got 6 severely wounded on board. I'm making for home. But we also did direction finding, which was the most important. A whole different set of instruments, and there'd be other people down the coast. And so the control centre could take bearings, and when they had bearings, they could compare them and so they got a fix. Oh yes, towards the end, we were listening to the Luftwaffe, and we had to learn Luftwaffe slang too. We could hear the planes coming, and of course, when they were carried away, they didn't mind their P's and Q's very much. And our rather prudish officer coming round and looking at what we're writing down would say, oh, you needn't really put that sort of thing in. That moves us very much.
So did you just write down the German, or did you translate?
We knew, of course, what we were writing. We could understand it, of course, all of it. But we wrote it in German, yes. For instance, I can tell you one bit of German slang was, ich habe Bauchweh, I've got a bellyache. And that meant I'm about to jettison my auxiliary engine. The Germans didn't know we were hearing them, but there were two people in the tower, now one of our stations on the Thames estuary, and they heard one pilot say, what's that funny little thing down there? Shall we drop something on it? And the other said, oh, better not, we better keep it. And so they got away from that one. From Abbotscliff, we could see when boats were hit, and sometimes a boat on fire would be blown towards us. That was not very nice.
You just did RT. You never did WT.
Never did WT. We were just taught a little of it. I knew a few things, but not more.
How often were you able to go home?
Well, once D-Day was approaching, we couldn't move at all. Everything was cut off. But before that, we could go in on this of what they call a 48. You have 48 hours off.
I was looking at your letters. Did you say that there were horses that you could ride in Kent?
Yes, I went for rides. That was rather jolly. That was nice, yes.
Do you remember D-Day itself, the invasion? Were you on duty?
We knew it was coming. We'd seen Mulberry Harbour being towed past us, and we knew what that was. Of course, we didn't know details of what they did, but we saw all the heavy stuff going by. We were so near the Germans across the channel that we knew something was brewing there, and we knew that was coming. I was actually on watch when the first V1s came over, and everything went a bit crazy then because I'm afraid our commanding officer, our Wren officer, wasn't very on the spot about it. She hadn't been told what would happen. Things were very tense. And of course, once the V1s were coming over, we were the area in which they were shot down. In the woods around us, there were anti-aircraft batteries. And sometimes if they hit one of these things, it would, instead of going on, it would turn over and come round and come so go for a nice country walk, and suddenly the woods all round you were alive with gunfire, and then you saw something had been hit and it came and seemed to be coming straight for you, which wasn't at all nice. However, that wasn't anything to worry about, really. You see, I had memories of the First World War because I remembered then the Zeppelins coming over in the First World War. So I was very superior. I said, this is only my second war.
When you were at Abbotscliff, Did you ever hear of a place called Bletchley Park?
No, we didn't know anything, absolutely nothing about Bletchley Park. Actually, I believe if you were promoted to a petty officer, say, you might be sent to Bletchley for a short spell. That was all I knew. I had a great friend, though, who was there, Arthur Cooper. He was a Japanese scholar, and his brother was there. His brother was Joss Cooper, who was well known at Bletchley Park. And there are a lot of stories about him, stories because he was a character, and he would take his teacup and throw it into the lake. And that family of the Coopers, they were not very handsome men. They were very extraordinary-looking people, really. But they had a beautiful sister. She was very beautiful. And she worked with a man who made films during the war. He made the official film of the post office and things like that.
Were you a lot older than the other Wrens?
I suppose I was. There was a very young Danish girl, Ellen Carsten, who was a great friend. But on the whole, they were all fairly mature, I think, knew what was going on. There was Pat Outram.
Yes.
Yes, I remember her very well. And Ray Spender. She was the singer, lovely voice, and very good. And there was, Alison Gerrish was another one. She was WT as well as RT, because they took WT, and they were in the same room with us. They would sometimes tell us what was going on in WT. And this one described the taking of Boulogne. And she said, what we hear is the occupying force saying, wir sind überrennt, and then, es lebe der Führer, Heil Hitler. And then silence, and Boulogne had fallen. Oh, yes, it's there, der Tricolor.
I understand a lot of the Y people moved to different stations. So did you meet a lot of people? Did everyone know everyone?
More or less, yes. They were good friends. I made a great friend at Loo. That was very good.
There were 400 special duty Wrens?
Yes.
In total, in all the stations, roughly.
When you were at Abbott's Cliff, it closed down. You were there when it closed?
No, I wasn't there. But the house still stood there, because when you went by the ordinary train from Folkestone, if you craned out of the window, you could see, just see it, perched on the edge of the cliff.
Where did you go after Abbott's Cliff?
I went for a short time to an East Anglian place.
Was that Sheringham?
Sheringham, near Sheringham, yes. It was very cold, and I had a friend who was at another station near Great Yarmouth.
Your work there, was that the same?
Same sort of work, yes.
So what did you do when you left the Wrens? Because I know many of the Wrens from Abbott's Cliff went to Germany.
Went to Germany, later in the war.
But you didn't.
I didn't, though. I went to do archaeology because I still had very strong anti-war feelings. A cousin of mine went out to assist one of the QCs at Nuremberg. But I didn't want to do that work. I didn't like the idea of it. I tried and was taught a little, but I didn't do it. So I stuck to archaeology.
Very wise.
I was doing mostly work in museums, and I was in Persia and work on the excavation of chariot tombs. I worked with very well-known archaeologists like Stuart Pigott.
When was the first time you told anyone about your wartime work?
Well, you see, Vicar was in the Foreign Office, but he was in MI5. And so when we heard him talking, and his wife was at Bletchley, Roseanne Colchester, we could talk to her, but not to anybody outside.
I know Pat Outram organised some reunions.
She did, yes.
Did you go?
No, I didn't go. I was having trouble by that time with my eyes, and I couldn't get them out very well.
She remembers you, and she said to send you her best wishes.
Nice. So. She was very nice, got on very well with her, and with Ray Spender, too.
Just to say once again, thank you very much, and it's been very, very interesting. Thank
yes.
you.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.